This is Eleanor Lacaine. Our country and the world is still grappling with the pandemic. We've also been experiencing some very weird weather, from wicked wildfires in the west to fierce hurricanes, floods, and droughts. What in the world is going on? Our guest today has an answer to that question. He sees the pandemic and weather changes as having the same root cause: human interference in nature. Dr. Samuel Myers is the founding director of the Planetary Health Alliance and a principal research scientist at the Harvard School of Public Health. Dr. Myers received his BA from Harvard College, his MD from Yale Medical School, and his MPH from the Harvard School of Public Health. He recently co-authored a very important new book called Planetary Health: Protecting the Planet to Protect Ourselves. He's here to talk with us today about the intersection of human health and planetary health. Dr. Samuel Myers, welcome to All Together Now.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Well, you're certainly a very credentialed man, so you probably know what you're talking about.
I'm not sure those two things always go together.
Well, you got Harvard and Yale. That's not too bad a combo. So I'd like to start off, your book is very deep and very broad about what it covers. And I want to start by asking you just to explain to our listeners briefly, if you would, what do you mean by planetary health?
Yeah, so planetary health is really an emerging field that's only 5 or 6 years old that has been spreading very quickly around the world, that focuses on understanding the human health impacts of our own vast transformation of Earth's natural system. So the climate system, biodiversity, land cover, you know, all these ways that our activities are transforming and disrupting our natural systems. And, you know, in your intro, it almost sounded like I thought that was kind of, you know, we were tampering with nature. It's inadvertent, which is one of the challenges, right? So it's not that we're going around trying to change all of these natural systems. It's just that the scale of the human enterprise, the scale of our sort of collective activities now really outstrips our planet's capacities to absorb our wastes or provide the resources that we're using sustainably. And as a result, we are disrupting most of our natural systems. And then planetary health tries to understand how that disruption comes back to affect our own health and well-being.
Yeah, very good. And of course, the topic of the hour is the COVID-19. Talk about impacting our health. And I've seen a few kind of brief references to this comes out of a bat in China, and maybe we shouldn't be having, you know, selling live animals at these markets and so forth. But can you give us a little deeper understanding of how it is that you see the COVID-19 came about due to human interference with natural systems?
Sure. I mean, you know, COVID-19 is one of these sort of unsurprising surprises. It's been forecast for a long time. It's a zoonotic infectious disease, which means that it's transmitted between wildlife and humans. And it appears that in this instance, it came out of live animal markets in China, where lots of different species of wildlife are brought together in close proximity that aren't usually brought together in nature. And then they're surrounded by people. And so it's a good way to have a virus jump from one animal population to another, where it can mutate or amplify and then go into a human population. And we think that's probably what happened in this case with a virus that may well have originated with bats and found its way to maybe a pangolin and then into human beings. I think more broadly, you know, there's an issue with human wildlife interactions and what's called spillover. And when people have studied the origins of these new emerging pathogens that make us sick, about 3/4 of emerging infectious diseases over the last 50 years or so have come from wildlife populations. So that's why I say it's not terribly surprising. And human sort of incursions into wildlife habitat have become more and more frequent and extensive. And they occur through bushmeat hunting, where people are hunting wildlife for consumption, through mining and timbering and other extractive industries, through agricultural incursions, where people are clearing forests for agricultural land, and through live animal trade and live animal markets. And so, you know, in some ways, COVID is really the latest in a whole series of kind of alarm bells that have been ringing across the planet over the last several years. You mentioned many of the other ones, the fires we're experiencing now, the hurricanes, the worst locust pandemic or outbreak in 70 years in Kenya, and the famine there. So there, we keep seeing these indicators of sort of a broken relationship between human beings and the natural world. And I think you could easily argue that COVID is one of those. I also think that COVID, you know, has a whole lot else to teach us with respect to planetary health that's much more positive in some ways. You know, we've seen suddenly for the first time in history, this massive global collective behavior change, which in many ways is what we've been calling for to address the challenges of climate and other kinds of global environmental change. So suddenly in the space of months, almost everybody in the world has started to live in a very different way. And that's pretty interesting. We've learned that science really matters, and that the places that take it seriously have had a whole lot fewer fatalities, so that it's really, you know, it's really an issue of life and death. We also have this huge opportunity now around the stimulus packages that are being developed, you know, trillions of dollars of all of our taxes that are going to go toward stimulating the economies and developing foreign assistance packages in response to COVID, where there's this opportunity to make those investments in, you know, a different way of living. So there are lots of ways that COVID becomes sort of relevant and interesting to this broader conversation about planetary health.
Good. I'd agree with all of that, except, yes, science does matter, but I'm not sure everybody got that message.
Well, but my point is that the ones that got it ended up protecting their populations a whole lot better than the ones that didn't.
Right, exactly. This is this may be the time of the scientists, we hope. You know, many people say that Rachel Carson, who wrote Silent Spring back in 1962, is the mother of the environmental movement. And a lot of what you're saying seems to resonate with what people were saying in the 60s and 70s with the rise of the modern environmental movement. How do you see this planetary health as related to and different from the rest of the environmental movement?
Absolutely. Well, so you mentioned our book, and in our book we pay homage to Rachel Carson. There's a whole section on sort of the intellectual kind of history of planetary health, and I agree with you that that's an important place to start. I also think there's some really important differences, and one of the things that's quite fascinating and that many people don't understand is how absolutely different the scale of human impacts on natural systems is today than it was in 1962. And so if you look at metrics of global human consumption, you know, whether you're talking about you know, water appropriation or proliferation of motor vehicles or production and use of synthetic fertilizers or paper plastic production or primary energy use, they all show these curves with very, very modest actual sort of global scale of consumption up until around 1960. And then since then, this almost exponential increase in the scale of human impacts or consumption. And similarly, if you look at metrics of our impacts on the natural system. So exploitation of fisheries or biodiversity loss or cutting down of forests or addition of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. You see these very similar curves of really modest impacts until the turn of the century or the middle of the century, and then this very, very steep rise. And the reason that they all look so similar is that they're underlain by these more fundamental processes. And one of them is human population growth, which, you know, in 1950, the population was around 2.5 billion people. Today, it's well over 7 billion. And per capita consumption, so the amount of goods and services that each of us consume on average, has risen even faster than population growth. And when you multiply those times each other, you get sort of just global GDP, the scale of human activity, the goods and services we're asking this planet to provide for us. And the difference between 1950 and today is really extraordinary. We're on this very almost vertical part of this curve now. And so there's just been this massive ballooning of humanity's total ecological footprint, of the impact that we have on our planet's natural systems, which is very, very different than it looked in the middle of the last century. And so I think the urgency of the moment that we face has to do with the scale and pace of our impacts on natural systems and the extent to which now they're threatening just about every dimension of human health. So Rachel Carson was focusing on toxics, on pollution. You know, the environmental movement came out of the Cuyahoga River being on fire and around these issues of clean air and clean water, and really the kinds of pollutants that we're putting into the environment that are affecting our health. But now what we're seeing is that we're disrupting the core fundamental natural systems that wrap around our planet, the climate system. We're fueling the sixth mass extinction of life on Earth, you know, huge changes in land cover and land use, global scale pollution of air, water, and soil, scarcity of resources like arable land and fresh water. And all of those big sort of system-wide changes are interacting with each other in complex ways that we're just starting to kind of figure out to affect the core conditions for human health and well-being, the quality and quantity of food that we can produce, the quality of air that we breathe, our exposure to infectious diseases and natural hazards, even the habitability of some of the places that we live. And so those changes ultimately are affecting every dimension of health. So it's a slightly different frame in terms of the scale of the problem and the nature of the problem itself, which is these sort of fundamental changes in the structure and function of our natural systems.
Right. And I appreciate in your book how you talk about it was human ingenuity and the drive to, say, provide better food for people so we had less starvation, and provide a better quality of life for people so you have a refrigeration for your food. So that the impulse was really good, and that in fact humans did succeed in reducing the percentage of people who were hungry around the world. And we did succeed in driving up quality of life for billions of people. So what we set out to do, we succeeded in spades, but there are all these impacts that have come from that, you know, innovation and drive that now we've got really a life and death situation. And I love that you talk about how all these planetary system changes that humans have impacted, that now that's impacting us in terms of our health. So to pick one piece of that, where a lot of people now focus more on the climate crisis, and you know, you mentioned there's multiple other environmental crises with the oceans and the fisheries and the, you know, you name it, we got a crisis. But looking at the climate crisis, how do you see the climate crisis is impacting human health now?
Well, you know, climatic disruption, first of all, you're right. I have a very hard time isolating one of these factors from the rest because they're all interacting with each other. And so, you know, climate change is exacerbating water scarcity and biodiversity loss then is, you know, amplifying the effects of climate change. And so these things are interacting. And I think we kid ourselves when we think we can look at them sort of in isolation. But that said, Obviously, climate change is one that we're particularly focused on. And there's no question, I mean, it's been pretty well established that there really are very, very significant health impacts of climate change. Many people have called it the biggest single threat to global health over the next century. And they fall into just about every domain. So you can kind of walk through the domains of public health and start with nutrition, and climate change is expected to reduce crop yields globally on average. It's also research that I've actually led has shown that rising carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere reduce the nutritional value of the food that we eat, of staple food crops. So when you grow crops like rice and wheat and soybeans at levels of carbon dioxide we expect to see by the middle of this century, they lose important amounts of their iron and zinc and protein, these nutrients that are actually super important for human health. And we've modeled the impacts of those changes on the health of populations in countries around the world and found that probably around 150 to 200 million people are likely to be pushed into new risk of zinc and protein deficiency, for example, as a result of rising CO2. You can move from nutrition to infectious diseases. And you go to the East African highlands and you find malaria climbing up it at higher and higher elevations as a result of warming temperatures. You see climate change affecting the distribution of vectors for vector-borne diseases. If you look at a map of Lyme disease here in the United States, you see the ticks and the disease moving much further north than they were even 20 years ago. And some of that is related to climate change. If you move to non-communicable diseases, warmer temperatures are involved in creating more smog. So the creation of ground level ozone, which is a really important part of smog, is actually a temperature sensitive reaction. So as it gets warmer, you see more of that. And so air pollution tends to be exacerbated. You see more allergic respiratory diseases, things like asthma, because we're getting more pollen and a longer pollen season. So many of your listeners have probably noticed that, hay fever gets a lot worse. It starts earlier, it lasts longer. Pollen production goes up. I think ragweed pollen goes up by 60% or something once you get to 550 parts per million. So the CO2 effect of that. So they're all really interesting effects on cardiorespiratory diseases. And again, this is just climate change. If you were asking me about planetary health more broadly, there'd be vastly more examples in each of these domains and their mental health effects that we're seeing, as well as this big sort of area that is really an active area of research now around population displacement and conflict and the extent to which climate change may be really making certain parts of the world uninhabitable, either because they're low-lying coastal regions where sea level rise and more intense storms are going to make flooding much more frequent. And again, the planetary health side of that equation is that we've also seen destruction of mangrove forests and coral reefs and wetlands and vegetated dunes. So the barriers that protect coastal populations have also been degraded. And so it's this land use change combined with climate change that's making coastal populations vulnerable. Physical labor is actually no longer possible, sort of prolonged physical labor in many parts of the world in the summer, because what's called wet bulb temperatures, this metric of temperature and humidity and wind speed, has risen to the point where people simply overheat. And so they can't do agricultural labor or other kinds of physical labor. And so you start to question, are places going to be at least temporarily uninhabitable? And then what happens when people that are under-resourced want to move, to get away from those problems into places where they're not welcome? And to what extent does that produce conflict? We also know that higher temperatures correlate with more violence here in the United States. They also correlate with more suicidality. And so there are mental health effects associated with warming temperatures. So there, you can dive into this literature and you can limit yourself to the climate question, or you can sort of look more broadly at how other factors interact with climate to create these conditions. But the bottom line is that rapidly changing environmental conditions, the most rapidly changing conditions in the history of our species, driven by our own activities, are now really threatening every dimension of human health. And we need to wake up to, you know, the understanding that continuing on this trajectory really isn't viable if we want to maintain global health. And so we need to get onto a different one.
Right, exactly. Well, you've laid out quite a grim picture there, which I think is actually a very accurate assessment of where we're at. Of all that you know, and you've obviously dived deeply into this whole area, what are you most concerned about? Like, is there one thing that makes you wake up in the middle of the night and not go back to sleep?
I'm most concerned about a failure of leadership. You know, this journey that Howie Frumkin and I should make the point that he and I edited this book together, and it's been really a wonderful partnership, and a whole bunch of co-authors contributed to it. But this journey that we've been on, you know, for me, started with questions about can we get ourselves out of this mess? And, you know, the whole second half of our book is about solutions, which we haven't talked about yet. But along the way, I started to understand that that was really not the right question. That we absolutely can get ourselves out of this mess. That when you start to look at the extraordinarily rich terrain of solutions across every dimension of human activity, from food systems to energy systems to the built environment to manufacturing to chemistry, it's just full of really exciting, innovative solutions. The question is, will we get ourselves out of this mess? And that's really a question about political will and leadership and collective action, and whether we'll have a globally activated citizenry that holds governments and industries accountable. It's a much thornier question in some ways, but I think it is the question. And so when you ask, what do I worry most about? It's when I look around today, I see, you know, the Trump administration in our country, I see Bolsonaro's administration in Brazil. I see, you know, around the world, fairly nationalist, conservative institutions and governments. And I don't see evidence of a huge amount of really enlightened leadership. And I think that's what it's going to take to get us where we need to go.
Right. I share that concern. And I also share your view that, you know, we can solve all of our problems. I actually spent 20 years going around the United States looking for the best of what's working in different areas, like helping kids with autism and education and green job. We have incredible innovations. You know, really, like, you take any one of those and you could transform the whole field and boom, problem solved. But we're not learning from what we know works. And there are vested interests that block some of these innovations. Like, we know we will do better with renewable energy sources, but the fossil fuel industry has been so powerful at funding the climate deniers that they create confusion among people about, is this real? And and they fund the candidates and elected officials who then kind of turn the other way instead of taking the leadership we need. So when you know that there are solutions and yet you're looking at the blockages, like, how do you see that we're going to get around those obstacles to building on the solutions that are in front of us?
Well, you know, as I'm sure you know better than most, federal government has never led major societal change, right? So it wasn't the federal government that led on, you know, getting rid of slavery, on giving women the vote, on civil rights. You know, people need to lead. People coming together, building movements and coming together in collective action and insisting that their governments behave differently is what creates social change. And so I think it's easy, you know, to sort of throw up our hands and say, oh my God, we're paralyzed because, you know, we have a benighted administration around the issues that we care about. But in fact, you know, now is the time to organize. And I think that there's a lot of sort of evidence globally of that kind of organization. I think that, you know, whether it's the climate strike movement or Extinction Rebellion or, you know, you name it. I mean, the Sunrise here in Massachusetts, Mothers Out Front, you know, there are a lot of really exciting organizations that are bringing people together in collective action. And so one answer to your question, in my opinion, is we need to be activated and we need to come together and demand change. The second answer is that, you know, in many instances, you know, there are lots of different layers of government, and federal government in this country, there's a lot that it doesn't cover. And so there's a huge role for state municipal leadership. So you look at what California, you know, announced yesterday, right, around not allowing gas cars anymore. I think it was in 2035. I can't remember the year, but they're only going to allow electric cars. Well, that sends a massive signal, right, to the automobile market. And so that's a hugely powerful thing that can be done at the state level. Cities are doing all kinds of really, really exciting things around public transportation and the way cities are designed, creating neighborhoods and trying to move away from reliance on automobiles and creating green spaces. So there's a lot that can be done at other levels of government as well. And often those levels of government work more effectively than our current national level.
No, exactly right. You know, they've got the laboratories of democracy, as Justice Brandeis called them.
Yeah.
States doing great work. And cities, we had a fellow on this show not that long ago, wrote a book about what mayors are doing, leading the way on responding to the climate crisis. So there's tremendous work happening at the local and state level. So thank goodness for that. And hopefully we'll get some of that enlightened leadership soon at the federal level. And if not, then we'll push whoever's there to do what needs to be done.
I think that's right.
That's up to us. Right.
And yep.
So I'm wondering, you talked about solutions and you've looked a lot about what do we do about this planetary crisis, you point out, the human impact that's destroying natural systems, which in turn is impacting our human health in big ways. What are some of the solutions that you do see? Like if you were to have the ear of the next president, what would you say would be the top three things the next president needs to do right away?
Well, I wouldn't say anything until I had a chance to really sit down and think that through, because it's too important a question not to think about more than I have. So I don't know what the three things are, but I guess there are a couple of things I would say to that question. The first is, you know, we hear a lot about climate change. And when you talk about these issues, people always conflate what I'm talking about immediately with climate change, because it sounds so similar. Mm-hmm. And I actually think it's important to understand that what we're talking about is broader than climate change. It's everything change. And the causes are deeper than, you know, just our energy choices. It's sort of how we do everything. Because the fundamental problem is, as I said, the scale of human activity, the scale of our global ecological footprint, and it's outstripping our planet's capacity to absorb our waste or produce the things that we're using. And so when you think about solutions, you need to go upstream and say, well, okay, so how do we address the scale of humanity's global ecological footprint? And the answer is there are, you know, all kinds of things that we can do to really reduce that. In some ways, the good news is that we're massively inefficient in how we live on Earth. And so all of those inefficiencies are opportunities. And so, you know, you can go by system, but you look at the food system, and globally we waste about a third of the food that we produce. You think about, you know, the ecological toll of all of that wasted land and water and agrochemicals and energy that goes into the agricultural industry, and all of it's just getting wasted. So we need to address food waste. You can think about what we eat, and there's a huge opportunity for some dietary modifications so that we're eating less animal source foods, particularly in the wealthy parts of the world, and more plant-based foods. It turns out, and this is a recurring theme in planetary health, that when you do that, there are huge health co-benefits. And really across the board, so many of the things that we could be doing to address our ecological footprint would also provide these really important health co-benefits that would make us live healthier lives, or that would have economic benefits. And then once you've changed diets, you have to think about how we produce our food. And there are just really exciting innovations in precision agriculture and using techniques from agroecology in creating foods in totally new ways, like protein fermentation. So we're synthesizing, milk that's identical in terms of its amino acid composition from microbes. We're eating vegetable-based burgers from Impossible Burger or Beyond Meat that are being sold by the millions now because people like their taste, but their ecological footprint is dramatically lower. So there are all of these kinds of innovations that can be achieved across the food system. And similarly, the energy system, as people are much more familiar with, there's this huge opportunity to switch to renewables. And I'm actually really, really encouraged that, it's funny, there was a little tiny paragraph buried deep in the Boston Globe on, B8 or something in a business roundup that talked about how in 2010, a quarter of new energy capacity globally was renewable. And this year, two-thirds of new energy capacity globally was renewable. And that's just an extraordinary transformation that we should be celebrating as a great achievement. And so there's a huge amount we can do, obviously, in speeding that transition away from fossil fuels, in manufacturing. There's a whole movement towards the circular economy and trying to be much more efficient in the way we use materials for producing goods. And so across the board in chemistry, we can think about the whole sort of green chemistry industry that needs a lot of support. So really, when you walk through the domains of human activity, there are all kinds of opportunities to do things in a way that is just much more sensible, that's better for our own health and well-being, and that really reduces our ecological footprint.
Yeah, that's great. I'm going to take a minute now and just show our viewers and our listeners can't see it, but I'm holding up now a wonderful copy of this important new book that I want you all to read. It's called Planetary Health, Protecting Nature to Protect Ourselves, edited by Samuel Myers and Howard Frumpkin. And really, everybody, read this book. It's just chock full of incredible information. And even though it sounds kind of grim, because it is true, human activity has impacted our ecological natural systems in such a way that we're drawing down from what the planet has to give, and that's totally not sustainable. But at the same time, the book shows some of these innovations and solutions that Dr. Myers is talking about here. So it's actually a very hopeful book. And it's important for us to be aware. Sometimes we just think of our own personal situation, or we think about the issue that we care about. This has got a very broad reach, so you kind of open up and see how our individual daily choices have been impacting the national and global scope of nature and what that means. So, Dr. Myers, I'm wondering, since you know so much about how damaging some of these individual choices can be with the big imprint we're leaving ecologically, how has that affected some of the individual choices you've made? And what do you recommend for our listeners who share your concern and want to know what they can do? They may not be president of the country, but, we all make decisions every day about how we live and what we eat. So what do you think are the most important things for us as individuals to be doing to be part of the solution?
Yeah. Well, I think that those contributions, in at least the way my brain works, sort of fall into three categories. And the first is kind of a personal audit that you can do of yourself or your family. And, you know, you can think across those same kinds of domains. So what do you eat? There's all kinds of research, and there have been lots of papers talking about the sort of different ecological footprint of different diets. And so clearly transitioning toward a more vegetable-based diet, particularly with less red meat, lamb and beef and pork, has really positive impacts in terms of, how we affect natural systems. It also, especially, with the exception of very, very poor populations in lower income countries who get almost no meat in their diet, but for the U.S. population, that transition is also really positive for our health. Then you can think about, how do you get around? Are there ways that you can substitute moving around by foot or on a bicycle, but sort of muscle-powered locomotion as opposed to driving your car, which again, have a lot of co-benefits. They're good for you because you're getting more exercise. They improve air quality, so they're good for other people. They reduce motor vehicle accidents, so there are a lot of co-benefits for doing that. You can think about how you're living. Is your house efficient? Can you install storm windows? Can you, create other efficiencies in your appliances? Can you downscale the size of the place that you're living? And what about your neighborhood? Can you work with your neighbors to make it more bike friendly and more walking friendly, and plant trees to reduce urban heat islands, and create parks that bring community together with social connectedness and improve mental health? So there's all kinds of stuff that you can think about and where you live. So you can sort of go through these dimensions and what do you buy? As you consume goods, can you recycle things? Can you consume fewer things? Can you use secondhand things? And this is not a story of deprivation. This is not about reducing quality of life, but it's about giving a careful thought to what we consume and also to how it's produced. When we buy things, do we think about, what kind of principles the companies that produce it have? And can we support companies that are embracing circular economy and more efficient ways of producing their goods? So that's kind of the personal audit. How do I live, and what within all the dimensions of how I live, how do you get around? How much air travel do I have, et cetera, et cetera? The second category is depends on who you are. So, if you're a student in university and you're just getting started, you can think about, how can I be part of the solution? And one of the interesting things about planetary health is that there's no set of skills that isn't relevant. So, if you're an artist and a writer, we need new stories about our relationship to nature and our place in the world. And we need to reinvigorate the sort of reverence that many of us feel toward the natural world the sort of agency, the authority to guide our decisions. We need new stories to tell ourselves about relationship to nature. If you're interested in law or government, there's obviously a huge role for you there. If you're interested in engineering and technology, that's super important. The sciences as well. So across the board, can you be part of the solution towards this transition to what we call the great transition, or other people call the great turning, but moving toward a more positive way of living on Earth? If you're in business, can you create, a business model that has a lower footprint? Or can you create a new business that is like Beyond Meat, or that's like, this zero waste platform that Loop has just introduced, or, many other needs for innovation? The final thing category is getting outside yourself completely. And it's what I was talking about before, because at the end of the day, unless you're the founder of some company that transforms the way we think about these things, one's individual decisions can only go so far. And so coming together in collective action becomes really important. So find your partners. You know, whatever the issue is, whether it's climate or biodiversity or waste or food, you know, there are other people with those same passions, and come together in collective action and put pressure on government at whatever level makes sense to you to make changes. But there are two really big benefits of that. One is that your power multiplies. And as you know, you were talking about, you know, these industries, and you were talking about, you know, exploitative industries and fossil fuels and legislative capture. And the way you address those problems, which Marshall Gans calls power problems, not knowledge problems, is through collective action, right? It's by creating power on the other side and pushing. And so you need to find your partners for that. The other benefit beyond creating more power is your own mental health benefit. And that's one of the things we talk about in this book in the mental health chapter, but that actually one of the sort of antidotes to the kind of apathy and despair that a lot of people feel when they look at the scale of the kinds of problems that we're talking about and think, well, how can I possibly make any difference when we're talking about, you know, global biodiversity loss or the sixth mass extinction or these just huge global problems? By coming together and working with other people, you find companionship and shared passion. And it's actually a wonderful antidote to some of that despair and gives people a sense of agency that they don't otherwise have. And so I think it's valuable for both those reasons.
Yeah, very well said. And just to underscore, one of the things you point to is how much opportunity there is just by reducing waste. When you talk about waste in the food system, it's incredible the amount of food that after all the chemicals and work and the water used up and the fossil fuels to transport it across the country, and then boom, it ends up getting thrown away. You know, I order food once a week from a company called Imperfect Food, and they divert food that would be on its way to be tossed because it's an irregular shape or something, so it won't be sold by a main grocery store, but they sell it and send it right to your door, and it's been fabulously delicious food.
Yeah, I was hearing about a business from my nephew in New York City that is called like Ugly Something Smoothies, but it's the same thing where they're using fruit and vegetables that wouldn't be sold otherwise because they have blemishes, and they're turning them into these absolutely delicious smoothies that have gotten very trendy in Brooklyn, I guess. But it's another example of exactly that.
Right. And if you want to look at opportunities for cutting waste in energy, you know, we talk about all the great innovations, and renewable, by the way, are now more expensive than fossil fuels. The only reason we're still using any coal is because the federal government subsidizes it, which is, the, you know, talk about insane. We're subsidizing exactly what we should be shutting down immediately. But just on pricing, renewables with solar and wind are now cost competitive with fossil fuels. So we win on the pricing. If we had a real free market, we would have more renewable. And as you mentioned, they are on the rise in the US and around the world. So that's a good thing. So it's great to have the renewables, but the other places go upstream and stop the waste of energy. If yep. we would cut the waste in energy, we could cut half of the energy use in the United States would be stopped. I worked on this for Boston Edison for many years, developing the next generation of energy efficiency programs, but the level of waste and energy is astounding. So all, you know, just stop wasting it and we reduce the demand in half. So, you know, that appeals to my New England nature. So
No, you're absolutely right. That's what I mean about these massive inefficiencies, which really are opportunities. I totally agree with you.
Yeah. And so that's a lot of what we can do individually and as citizens. You do talk in your book, too. We absolutely need to put the pike to the government officials and get them moving more in these directions more quickly. And also businesses. Now, you know, been tremendous progress in a lot of the business. I'm so excited to see the work done by Ceres. They're based in Boston, where you are, my friend Mindy Luber.
Yep.
Just getting the money and getting the insurance companies to be directed by the hundreds of billions and trillions into the new green economy. So, hats off. That's great. But what do we do about the laggards? And you talk in your book about, you know, some kind of mix maybe of incentives and penalties that will provide the necessary motivation for changes by some of these bigger actors.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think one of the interesting things in the, we have two chapters, one on businesses and one on economics. One of the points that the authors in the business chapter make is that one of the things that's really driving innovation in the business sector is changes in the valuations of externalities. And so in some ways, that's something that we can do as, and I'll explain that in a second, but that's something we can do as citizens. And it's also something that governments can do. And so what I mean by that is if you're a company that is, you know, producing hamburgers and you're selling cheap hamburgers, and it turns out that you're sourcing your beef from, you know, the Amazon. And so, the cows are being fed on pastures where they cut down, you know, primary Amazonian rainforest with enormous biodiversity and graze cattle for a year or two before the nutrients are gone, and then they have to do it again. And so it's extraordinarily destructive. And then when you eat these burgers, your rates of heart disease go up and stroke go up. And so you're more likely to have heart attacks and go into the hospital and need a quadruple bypass surgery, which actually the rest of us have to pay for because it turns out that you're on Medicare, for example. Well, so there are all of these externalities associated with that business of selling people cheap hamburgers. There's, you know, massive biodiversity loss. There, the carbon emissions associated with removing the forest. There, the health costs for, the United States citizens that are subsidizing your health care. And yet the company is allowed to sell the cheap hamburger and doesn't actually have to pay any of those costs. We pay those costs. And so those are the externalities. I think what's happening as people begin to understand the moment that we're in and the urgency of addressing these issues is they weigh those externalities differently. And so they're less likely to give their business to a company that's making money by destroying the global commons, by, you know, taking away the future for our grandchildren, that they can see it in those terms and say, you know what, you don't get my dollar. I'm going to put my dollar for this Beyond Burger, which tastes terrific, or this Impossible Burger, which tastes just as good, but doesn't destroy the Amazonian rainforest. And so there's one dimension of this, which is consumers putting pressure on businesses, which changes the calculation around those externalities. Another dimension of it is that governments can change the externalities so that, for example, we can stop allowing companies to sell incredibly cheap, really, really unhealthy processed food. And we can say, you know what, we're going to actually price in the externality of the health costs associated with selling those sugar sweetened beverages or, you know, junk food in markets so that the price that people pay reflects the true cost to society. And instead, we're going to subsidize with the money that we get from that healthy foods, you know, like fruits and vegetables and nuts and seeds and legumes and things that we really want people to be eating more of. And that will reduce our healthcare costs and protect the global environment. And so that's a way that government decisions can affect the playing field that businesses are operating on, both in, you know, in terms of carrots and sticks, the stick being the taxes and the carrots being the subsidies. And so, you know, across the board, there's sort of this, I think, triangle between an activated citizenry that's knowledgeable about the issues and then the enlightened government that's creating an environment where businesses that are doing the right things can thrive. And eventually they put pressure on the private sector to operate, even if what their goal is only to maximize their profits, it changes what they do.
Yeah, those are great examples. And I love that whole approach of true costing, whether that be around the food with the health costs from the heart attacks, from the cheap burgers, or whether the true costing be in the environment when you're actually considering the drawdown of our natural resources and on the front end and then the waste on the back end. So if you actually did true costing in those areas, you'd see things change very quickly. So I think that's one of those key trim tab things. If we could do that, then a lot of behaviors would change along with it. Speaking of behavior change, I'm really curious that you're a medical doctor and you're working in the School of Public Health because you also have a master's in public health. And how is it, you know, Harvard is not always known for being on the cutting edge of the revolution to make changes in the world. How are you being treated? First of all, how did you get this whole viewpoint to have a foothold there in the Harvard School of Public Health? And what is your experience of working with the other professors, whether it be Harvard Medical School or the School of Public Health? How receptive are the professors at Harvard to the kinds of changes that you're talking about we need to make?
Well, that's a loaded question.
I'll turn the tape off if you want.
Right. No, I mean, I think so. So there are two elements to that. One is sort of how did I get there? And the other is how what's my community like and how is this stuff received? And but how did I get there? You know, I'm sort of a poster child for a pretty non-linear career path. So I've been kind of wandering around in the wilderness trying to figure things out and learning a lot of things that had nothing to do with medicine along the way. I mean, in some ways, you know, it's a story of going further upstream, right? So if you're a physician and you're taking care of sick people, and then you start to think about root causes and, well, what's making those people sick? And you start to get really interested in public health. And, you know, that starts to teach you to think about the health of whole populations and how to optimize health across a population. And, you know, then you start to realize that, you know, it's great to be doing, you know, vitamin A supplementation and vaccines and seatbelt laws and smoking cessation programs. But if you're doing that while your house is on fire and all the biological systems around you are starting to crumble, then you're sort of missing the main story. And so you need to go even further upstream. And so in some ways, it's been kind of a story of going further and further upstream and recognizing that actually the way we live is, you know, the fundamental problem that's actually threatening our own health and well-being, and particularly the health of, you know, our grandchildren and future generations. In terms of how that's received, I mean, the answer is that there's actually a very vibrant community at Harvard. What's interesting, and I don't think this is unique to Harvard, is that it's completely undefined. That I have tons of friends and colleagues with whom I do research and with whom I work. Some of them are at the Harvard Divinity School. Some of them at the Harvard Business School. Many of them are in the natural sciences at the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, and they work in climate science and biology and ecology and plant physiology and fisheries ecology. Some are in atmospheric transport science. And so the nature of the problems that we're talking about is that they're extraordinarily interdisciplinary. They don't only cross disciplines, they cross whole fields and they cross all the schools at Harvard University. And so in some ways, a university is the perfect place to address the kinds of things that I'm talking about, because you have people who are knowledgeable across all of these different domains. In other ways, it's very problematic because we organize ourselves in this very siloed disciplinary fashion. And so there's no actual structure at the university that really brings us together effectively across these disciplines to tackle problems that are of societal importance. We're supposed to tackle problems that are of great disciplinary significance that are sort of intellectually interesting, but not necessarily important from a societal standpoint. And so there's a piece of work to do. And I don't think, again, this is unique to Harvard. I think that this is an issue across the world where universities are waking up to the need to create new arrangements where we come together across disciplines to tackle these big societal questions. And we need to learn how to train, you know, our students in a different way as well. You know, we need to try to figure out how do we teach planetary health effectively? How do we create certificates in planetary health that bring together, you know, people from the business school who want to understand these issues before they go out and create new businesses, as well as people in the divinity school who want to understand these issues before they go out and minister to the spiritual needs of their population? And so they're relevant to everybody. And you know, how do we train people so that they have deep disciplinary expertise, which is important, but they also have an eye to connecting that with other people's disciplinary expertise to solve problems that go outside their own disciplines? And, you know, that's about training, it's about funding, it's about how we promote, and all of that needs some careful thought. So Harvard's actually been pretty engaged in that conversation. There's an active conversation right now going on at the School of Public Health that I'm excited about as we really think about how we can arrange ourselves to take on some of these problems.
That's great. I love that. And I would apply that, by the way, when I read you in your book talking about the importance of organizing around solving problems in the university, I immediately went to think about that's how we can be organizing our government now. If we we don't have time to create whole new organizations that are interdisciplinary in nature, but we can do task forces where we bring people together from the different agencies to say, what do we do about this issue? So I'm very excited about your work and your wonderful book. And I have to have you come back because I want to learn more about the Planetary Health Alliance. And could you give us like 30 seconds? What happens with the Planetary Health Alliance?
So I founded the Planetary Health Alliance with colleagues about 5 years ago, and I now direct it. And the Alliance is a group of over 240 organizations in over 40 countries that's based at Harvard School of Public Health. But that includes all of these other groups. And it's a coalition of organizations that are all committed to really seeing the growth of this field. Some of them are focused on research, some are focused on education, some are out in the field actually implementing planetary health in action, some are focused on policy and government, many are NGOs, many are universities, some are government agencies. But it's just basically the community really working towards building this field. And we have an annual meeting every year. This year's will be online. We publish a newsletter every month, and we're creating a whole sort of technology platform to allow people from around the world to come together around these questions. So certainly we welcome your audience to the Planetary Health Alliance, and you can Google us and sign up for our newsletter.
That's fantastic. And I hope our listeners read the book, Planetary Health. That's all the time we have. Dr. Samuel Myers of Harvard School of Public Health, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your groundbreaking work.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. Thank you for having me.